Get a jump start on 2024 in a new Kia from Robert Brogdon's Olathe Kia. Shop their large selection, including the new Sorento, Niro, and Soul models. You'll score big with low prices, trade assist cash, and a 30-day money-back guarantee. Visit OlatheKia.com.
That's Buster Olney's music. Good morning, Buster. How are you?
What's going on? I'm up. I'm watching the game.
Yeah, what's going on? Any gigantic stories involving any Major League Baseball superstars happened to break yesterday?
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my goodness is right.
Yeah. It's interesting because, you know, the excitement that we all had knowing that the Dodgers would open the season with these two games in Korea, which I'm watching now. I'm sure you guys probably have it on a television there. You know, getting fired up to see the top of the Dodger order. All of that right now is obscured by the story that was, done by my colleague Tisha Thompson about, Otani and his interpreter who got fired.
So if there's people that are out there that, you know, going to work or school and don't, I mean, could you kind of give us the Cliff Notes version of exactly what's going on and why this is so disturbing for Major League Baseball?
Yeah, so I think that, you know, it would probably be best to sort of stick to the timeline. You know, there was information that developed during a federal investigation looking into a bookmaker in Southern California, and it's illegal to bet on sports in Southern California. A bookmaker was being investigated, and within that, there emerged some payments that were made from the account of Shohei Ohtani. And so as this was being, asked about by Tisha and ESPN, you know, initially the representatives for Ohtani, indicated that the person who needed to answer the questions was his interpreter, Ipe, who you guys have seen during the Home Run Derby, during other places. He is side by side. He's very close, has been very close with Ohtani. You know, they live together. And Ipe spoke with Tisha the other day and talked about how Ohtani helped him with his own gambling debts, which involved hundreds of thousands of dollars. And then the next day, that story was changed. And instead, what Ohtani's representative said was that Ohtani had no knowledge of the gambling debt. And the interpreter was fired yesterday. And this is after working for Ohtani during the Dodgers' first game. If you were watching it, you saw Ipe, alongside Ohtani. He was fired, and so now I think we have a situation where this will be continued. The conversation will be continued. The federal investigators will continue to do their work. Obviously, journalists like Tisha are going to continue to do their work, and we'll see if we get more clarity on it. But, yeah, it is a huge story involving someone who, let's face it, for the Dodgers, for Major League Baseball, for CAA, who represents Ohtani, he's someone who is not only, someone who is a face of their respective organizations, but he also is an incredibly valuable financial asset.
And we're talking about the transfer of $4.5 million from Ohtani's bank account to a bookmaking operation under federal investigation.
Correct. And there is definitely a lot of smoke, and there's a lot of contradiction in what was said to ESPN from one day to the next, and it is a story that's going to get a lot of attention when you're talking about the most famous baseball player in the world.
I mean, like, if you're the commissioner, if you're Major League Baseball, you got to be scared to death right now, right? Because, like, it's a huge hypothetical, but like, what if they did find out that it was Ohtani making some bets?
Well, you would assume at some point Major League Baseball, to this point, as far as we know, Major League Baseball is not committed to investigating this. But given the history of gambling within Major League Baseball, it feels like inevitably they're going to have to step in and do their own investigation. And so we'll see. In the past, when it comes to other matters like investigations under the domestic violence policy. They will wait for the officials, entities, federal investigators or local investigators to do their work, and then they'll follow in behind them. And I would not be surprised if that's what happens here, because they have to answer a lot of the questions we all have for themselves.
You know, Bush, I've been thinking about this ever since, gambling started becoming legal in many parts of the country. Baseball, you mentioned baseball's history with gambling. I mean, look, in baseball, Pete Rose, you're out forever, right? Like, you're a lifetime ban. They took this ridiculously, I don't want to say ridiculous, they took a very hard line stance back in the Black Sox scandal era to on gambling. We've seen other sports have issues with guys getting involved in gambling here recently since this happened, and they get punished, maybe suspended for a year, something like that. But we're not talking about lifetime bans. Is baseball going to have to change their approach to this? Will they still have this really hardline stance on it in the new climate that we're in? Is there much conversation about that?
Well, I think anybody who watches shows now knows that baseball has changed its perspective on it, right? They've essentially they've made deals. You can find betting odds within Major League Baseball entities, when they started down that road, you also felt like, well, they better be prepared for the inevitable situation that happens. That inevitably, there's going to be a player who makes bets. Not only sports bets, but potentially bets on his team or bets on baseball. And that is a really slippery slope for baseball to go down. But they had to be prepared for that once they essentially fostered the gambling.
What's next in this story, in this investigation? Because it feels like this is getting ready to balloon and just become a gigantic story. I mean, it takes a big story to overshadow the first day of the NCAA tournament, and this might be that kind of story.
100%. And, what we saw in the last 48 hours was, Ipe, the interpreter, essentially being isolated. And, the Dodgers cutting ties from him. The statement yesterday, that there was a massive theft that Ohtani was a victim of, that was not, written up in an indictment from some prosecutor. That was put out by Ohtani's representation, okay? So they clearly were, in the last events, the last 48 hours, they were pointing the finger at Ipe. And now as we go forward, you would assume that the federal investigators will do their work. We'll see if they develop more information. We'll see if reporters also develop more information. And then Major League Baseball, as I say, because of the history of gambling within the sport, and because of Ohtani's prominence, it seems that at some point they're going to have to do their own investigation to satisfy themselves that their most prominent player was not involved in gambling.
Well, so Buster, one of the things, this is a random aside, when we talk about like the influence of gambling on sports and everything, I saw ESPN's going to be updating win probability like constantly, right, during games. I think that's the release that I saw. The games that I've been doing on soccer, we've been getting a lot of feedback on. They want to update win probability through the course of the game, and we've been kind of talking about what the purposes of that are. I'm kind of curious what your thoughts are on like how that stuff affects the way people watch games and how we broadcast games. How much we should focus on things like win probability through the course of a game.
Yeah, that is true that we're going to be doing win probability now. I don't know if it's going to be something you're going to see innings 1 through 9. I don't know if it's just going to be limited to a graphic on television. I'm not part of the broadcast in Korea the way that I'm going to be during Sunday Night Baseball. But my understanding is that we will, constantly update what those are. And look, you'd have to be naive not to think that, someone who was watching the game and was interested in placing a bet wouldn't be paying attention to that. I think that you know, gambling, which, you know, was very popular to begin with, and then when you're seeing all these leagues now basically, you know, playing into that, but, you know, going with the wind on it instead of distancing from themselves from it, inevitably it's going to foster gambling. And that's reality. And it feels like that there's more, you know, of a tempered attitude toward it within the country. I don't know this to be a fact, but reading that story yesterday, it was noted that, you know, gambling on sports is allowed in 40 states. It's not that big of a deal, like the way it would have been, you know, it wouldn't have been considered it illegal, or it would have been considered illegal for so many years. And now it's not. It's becoming part of the experience of following sports for a lot of people. And as I say, it was, to me, it's always been inevitable. And we're seeing it in, you know, college sports. We're seeing it in other, in the NFL. You're having situations where players are getting caught up in it. So we'll see if, you know, as the investigation goes, you know, does that touch Otani more directly than what Ipe was maintaining yesterday in his interviews with ESPN? And we'll see.
Oh, boy, this will be a story that we'll be watching very closely with one of the superstars of baseball. And
I'm just going to be very transparent about this. You know, look, you know, we're all seeing the same bunch of facts. I don't think it's I think it would be, for me, wrong to speculate on what the various outcomes could be, because I don't know. I don't know where this is headed. We all see the contradictions in what's coming out in the last 48, you know, in the last 24 hours. And we all know what's at stake because of how important Otani is for all of these entities.
Well said, Buster Olney from ESPN. All right, Buster, let's move on. You mentioned it was kind of surprising to me that you know, there's some people out there, a good amount of people, like yesterday when we were talking about watching the game during the show, that didn't realize there were actually real regular season games that were counting being played right now in Korea. But that's what we've got, and right now the Padres are up 10-8 over the Dodgers. And we had this conversation last week about Yoshinobu Yamamoto, who signed the $325 million deal with the Dodgers. And, I mean, that's a gigantic deal to give any pitcher, much less a pitcher that has never competed in Major League Baseball. But he won the Triple Crown over in Japan, led the league in ERA, strikeouts, and wins. And so, I mean, most people thought he's a star waiting to happen. He had a really rough spring, and I asked you last week, should there be concern, or is this as our spring numbers don't matter? And you said there should be concern, and he got rocked today by the Padres. So that there's something else for the Dodgers to worry about right now.
Yeah, and that contract you mentioned, $325 million, it's the richest contract in baseball history spent for any pitcher. Hmm. And I told you the story last week that after he signed, I reached out to evaluators with other teams, and I said, so, you know, how good is this guy? And it surprised me that the feedback I was getting was not, oh, my God, this guy is a number one. You know, this guy, you know, like right now you're hearing about Cole Reagans. He's the left-handed DeGrom.
Ooh.
Like, that was not the sort of, you know, feedback that I was getting. It was, yeah, he's good, and there's a lot to like, and he's like a middle-of-the-rotation type guy. And really, part of the reason why the Dodgers made the investment in him was because of the fact he's so young, right? You don't see free agents at age 25.
Right.
But what I got back was a lot of cautionary. Yeah, there's going to be some adjustments he's going to have to make, and I think one of those is his delivery, which jumped out at me the first time I saw him this spring. Like, boy, he has such a delivery that he simplified last year because he was having a hard time holding runners. So he essentially developed this very simple step-and-throw delivery, and my first thought when I saw it was, man, that's how you see batting practice pitchers throw 100 times to each hitter before games. It's step and throw, step and throw, step and throw. There's no deception in the delivery. And so he's getting rocked today. I reached out to a pitcher who you guys know who pitched in the big leagues and has had a lot of deceptions delivery. And I was like, man, am I wrong? But at some point, you know, he may have bullied hitters in Japan with this very, you know, simplified delivery. But major league hitters, you're not going to bully them with your velocity at 98-99 if there's no deception delivery. And this pitcher got back to me immediately in the last 15 minutes and was like, yeah, it's not going to work for him. And so I wonder if you're going to see some adjustments where he's going to go back to a more complicated delivery, more deception, because right now it does look like batting practice.
So the first start for Yamamoto today against the Padres, one inning, four hits, five runs, one walk, two strikeouts. That ain't going to get it done. And so, and you make a good point about his age, 25 years old. But and maybe we know, maybe we don't know. But were there other teams that were close?
Oh yeah,
to $325 million. Like who else was? Because that's, I mean, if you're hearing those evaluations that he's, middle of the rotation guy or whatever, I mean, I know, I get the age thing, but what, the highest paid pitcher ever?
Right. To answer your question, the Mets, from what I understand, their financial offer was actually a little higher. The Yankees were in the same neighborhood. Other teams were in the same neighborhood. And then it felt like to a lot of them in the end that he had made up his mind he wanted to pitch for the Dodgers, which you can understand because he throws really hard. He's a phenomenal athlete. Like, he's a crazy great athlete. Historically, he's had excellent command. And so there's a lot to work with there. You know, your friend, Mr. Boddicker, will have more on that than I ever could offer. There are adjustments that he can make, but that it is, and maybe he has to go through some trial and error. He's going to have to deal with some failure with that delivery before they decide whether or not to go to something that isn't quite so transparent to hitters and has more deception in it. Because initially, what we've seen in the spring and what we saw today, it feels like major league hitters will be so readily able to time what he's throwing because of how simple his delivery is. I hope, I described it well enough for casual fans. It is like you're throwing to your kid in the backyard. You're not going to do some crazy windup. You're basically going to, step and throw. And for major league hitters, that is a gift to not have to try to figure out where to pick up the ball as the pitcher's coming through with his delivery.
$300-plus million for a guy who has to rebuild his delivery at the major league level sounds like a little problematic. On the flip side, the Giants in the same division are going to spend $62 million on Blake Snell, a two-time Cy Young winner. It took a long time for him to get signed, Buster. I hear he says he wants to pitch in that opening series for the Giants. Can he get ready that fast, and how big of a move is this for San Francisco?
Well, I do think he can try to get ready that fast. And let's face it, the history of these guys who sign late in spring training, generally speaking, is not good. It might be some time. In fact, I know that, the fact that it's dragged on for so long has affected the interest of some of the teams, where their feeling was, look, if you sign him late in March, and he also is known as a slow starter, you might not get an effective pitcher until the middle of the year. And if you're going to pay $31 million a year to a pitcher, that's not what you're looking for. You're looking a little return on investment. What an absolute disaster for him. Think about this. He turned down $150 million from the Yankees after Yamamoto turned down the Yankees. They turned to Blake Snell, made that offer of $150 million. Scott Boras, his agent, was looking for a lot more. And he winds up taking, this two-year deal for $62 million, for almost $100 million less. This is a guy coming off a Cy Young season. Last week, he was asked to throw for scouts for the Houston Astros and for the Giants. Think about that. A Cy Young Award winner essentially asked to audition for scouts. I tweeted out at like, that's like asking Tom Cruise to audition for community theater, I mean, the idea that he would have to do that, but that's the position he was in because of what happened and the way his free agency played out. And look, Scott Boras is the GOAT of super agents of baseball, and that nothing is ever going to change that. But it feels like, no question, he misread the market on this one and misread the perspective on his client. And it felt like he was shooting big and looking for something in the range of $200 million. I don't think there was any chance that the team's going to look at that. So, you know, for Blake Snell, I think it's a loss. For the Giants, you know, they get another Boris client at a really good price, having already signed Matt Chapman.
Buster Olney from ESPN, our baseball insider. Thank you so much, Buster. Hey, did you fill out a bracket for the tournament?
I did. I got UConn going, you know, and winning in the Final Four, and I'm feeling really good about it. But the biggest thing, like, I would love to win the ESPN bracket. I'd love to, you know, to win and make some money, but it's all about beating my 19-year-old son who talks so much smack.
Who does he have?
He's got Purdue winning the whole thing.
Purdue will flop. You got it.
Yep.
You'll have in-house bragging rights, Buster, I'm telling you, all right?
Awesome.
Thank you, Buster.
See ya.
That's Buster Olney from ESPN.
The best.
So, I'm telling you, man, the story is blowing up right now, and it's going to continue. Can you? I mean, just did you hear what I said?
Yeah.
$4.5 million out of Ohtani's account to a bookie that's under a federal investigation right now. That just doesn't go away.
No.
And then do you see the camera shots of him and his interpreter, like in the dugout? Did it look like a guy that? Oh boy, what do you think? What do you think? What do you think the commissioner's doing right now? Like, oh dear God, please. Pete Rose is like, well, hey, what's going on over there? How's everyone doing?
It's like,
Pete Rose is like Scott Drew right now. How's everyone doing today? How's everything going?
How did the NBA handle the Michael Jordan thing? What happened? What do we do?
Somebody wondered if the commissioner will force Ohtani to go play minor league basketball for the next, playing the G League for a couple of years.
Hello, how's everybody doing?
Right. Hey, commissioner, Pete Rose on line two.
Hello, how's everybody doing?
You're still banned, Click. Back after this on WHB. This music reminds me of my Uncle Phil, one of his favorite bands, so.
Great song.
Sing it then. Yep, you got the words down. If you could dream up the perfect guest to have on today.
I love you better.
Wow.
I knew that part.
You could not get a better guest.
We'll come back to you.
Than Mike DeCourcy. And look who we have on the show. Jake, you did it. Mike DeCourcy. Mike, good morning. How are you?
Hey guys, how you doing?
Doing great. How are you?
Well, I was good until I heard Nate singing Peg, right. And then now that set me back. You know, that was rough.
Well, I was good until I heard Bill Self tell me that Kevin McCullough's not playing the whole tournament, Mike. So none of us are doing great, all right?
You know, here's the deal, Mike. You need to come in here and settle Nate down because. We had a video where we, you know, picked our national champion as a show and, you know, upset specials and things like that. And Nate dared to say that McNeese is his upset pick and they're going to not only win in the first round but also upset Kansas. Now you have Kansas fans tweeting him that his Kansas fan card should be revoked. And Nate's firing back at people on Twitter, and then you've got a bunch of Kansas fans taking shots at Kevin McCullough, and Nate's mad about that as well, defending as well he should, defending the player. There's some unhappy people right now, and we haven't even started this damn tournament, Mike. So settle everyone down, would you?
I will say I have heard some of the, I haven't consumed any of it firsthand, but I had heard some discussion about a Twitter friend of mine pointed out she basically showed me a picture of her daughter's knee when her daughter had to end her college softball career and how messed up it was and how could people be saying Kevin McCullough should be playing and that he's not hurt enough or whatever. And I'm like, wait a second, people are really saying that? Are we doing this in 2024, really?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we're going to believe that there's a guy out there who has a chance to play in the NCAA tournament who just doesn't want to? I mean, come on. I mean, that's preposterous.
Thank you, Mike. It's been so gross looking at how many KU fans are just crapping all over this guy. And I guess my stance is I don't know what he's dealing with. How do any of us? You know, we're not in the locker room with him. I mean, there's a lot of people reading between the lines on what Bill Self. You can tell by the way Bill Self's answering this question that he thinks Kevin McCullough's a quitter. You know, and I don't. None of us know what he's dealing with, right? I mean, like that's the part that I guess it rubs me the wrong way the most. And it's like you love this guy, and then all of a sudden now you hate him because he's not playing in the tournament for you.
Nate, you've been in the business for a very long time. I have been in it even longer than that, much longer than that. And what you learn about athletes over the course of a close to a four and a half decade career is that they are competitors. You do not get to this point without doing everything you can to play and to play at the highest level possible. You can't get, especially now with what has evolved relative to training, you can't get there without being unbelievably committed to the sport, to the competition. And even if you're a selfish player, and that's not Kevin, but I'm just saying, even if you are a selfish player on the floor or on the field or whatever, on the ice or whatever, you still want to be out there. If you are not out there, then you are probably hurt, and probably hurt fairly badly. If you're not out there, especially in a circumstance like this where you might sit out a mid-February game against Cincinnati, because if you play this one, then you might be hurt more and miss the next three games against Texas, Oklahoma, and Oklahoma State or whatever. But you don't sit out an NCAA tournament because you're worried about your pre-draft camp. Guys don't do that. They do it because they can't go at the level necessary to be effective.
So what does this mean for Kansas? I was stupid enough to have them going to the Elite Eight if they had all their guys, and as soon as I found this out, I changed my tune quite a bit. But what does this mean for KU? What are they capable of now that we know he's not going?
Well, their history says not much. The history of this team says not a whole lot.
Yeah.
They're not capable of a whole lot. And now they have to supersede that somehow, and we have seen, not necessarily just with high majors that are banged up, but with other teams that aren't as talented as their opponents, purely talented as their opponents, go ahead and do special things. St. Peter's wasn't more talented than Purdue or anybody else they beat in the 2022 tournament, but they still got to the Elite Eight. So that's Kansas's challenge, really, is to sort of refashion itself as a plucky underdog. And I know that's not a easy mentality to immediately adopt, but that's their best case scenario. They have to know that right now they're not going to out-talent anybody in this deal. That's not to say that they still don't have abundant talent at the four positions that are left covered, but they have to be executing at a precise level in order to achieve. And if you watch the anatomy of any upset that we've seen in the tournament, it all goes back to that team is not giving up any ounce of any possession at either end of the floor.
Buster, Mike DeCourcy is our guest. Hey, Mike, so let's get into some of the games today, and maybe I'll just start here. Do you have any double-digit teams, double-digit seeds that you like a lot that we could suggest that our listeners pick for upsets in their brackets? It wouldn't be an upset according to Vegas, but you know, we like Drake against Washington State. I think Nate is all over McNeese. He has him going to the Sweet 16. I like Colorado State over Texas. I think we all pick Nevada. There's others out there. Is there anything in particular that stands out to you that screams upset today on the schedule?
Well, several of the ones that you mentioned are games that I picked as well. Nevada would be one. But I also circled James Madison against Wisconsin.
Yes.
I'm a big believer in teams that win all the time. because you know what they do? They win all the time. And that's very underrated.
That's a good point.
In college basketball, because people just say, well, the teams they're playing aren't that great. Yes, but they win all the time. And so when they play at Michigan State, they go up and win. And when they play at Kent State, they go up and win. And the only team that if James Madison were matched against App State in the first round, I would put all the money or whatever, or my pick or whatever, on App State, because App State had James Madison's number this year. They beat him twice, and both of them weren't dominant, but they were controlling victories for App State. But App State didn't make this deal because somebody else took them out, and James Madison never had to deal with them a third time. And that's a really good basketball team. Now, every 30-win team doesn't come in here and win, but they usually take a pretty good shot at it. The last year, Florida Atlantic, how'd they do? College of Charleston did not win their first-round game, but they were right there. So I like Wisconsin's team more than most. Usually when teams struggle late in the season, most of the public abandons them and decides they're not any good. I still believe in that team, but I don't love the fact that they were handed James Madison as a first round matchup.
Okay, so I mean, McNeese has 30 wins at 30-3. Samford is 29-5. I think Grand Canyon has 29 wins. So what about those three? That kind of fits your criteria. Do you have any of those three moving on?
I did not pick the others in addition to James Madison, but I think they all have a shot. They're very good basketball teams. You know, when I'm writing the same teams down on my mock week after week after week, that usually means that they're exceptional, that they're dominating their league. And it's not easy to dominate any league in college basketball, but those teams all did it. Grand Canyon was pretty much wire to wire, same for Samford. They were at McNeese as well. They were all basically wire-to-wire champions in their conferences.
Mike, can you tell us who you have as your Final Four?
I can. I've got UConn coming out of the East. Out of the West, I have Arizona. Out of the South, I have Kentucky. And out of the Midwest, I have Tennessee. And then I have UConn defeating Tennessee in the national championship game.
Oh, wow. I think I don't know, Nate, if you did, but I know Jake and I both picked North Carolina because we're looking for a one seed to lose, you know, in the first weekend. I think we picked them to lose to Mississippi State. Do you have any of the one seeds losing early?
I'm never, you know, in doing the brackets and doing them so publicly, I'm never, unless I really don't like a one seed, I usually don't have them going out at least in advance of the Sweet 16, because it does so rarely happen. I mean, it is very uncommon for that to happen. So I did not have Carolina losing. I can see them losing. I call the West region the region of the unreliables. You look at 1 through 6 in that region, and every team is a team you can't trust. You just can't believe in any of them. Carolina loses to NC State in the final of the ACC tournament. NC State, a mediocre team at best, having a good weekend. You lose to them, they're a rival. I mean, how am I supposed to trust that? How am I supposed to trust Arizona, which lost to the three worst teams in their league? I still maintain I don't think that's ever happened before in a major conference, but it happened with them. And then I could go all the way down the line, all the way to the 6-seed Clemson, which just got handed a quarterfinal game in the ACC tournament against Boston College. And not only lost, Boston College is one of those teams that fights you as hard as they can. So maybe you lose by 2 or 3 points. No, that's not good enough for Clemson. They go out and lose by like 18. I mean, how am I supposed to trust any of those teams?
Right, before we let you go, I wanted to ask you about three teams. We have a lot of listeners that follow, you know, Midwest local schools. Iowa State, boy, we'd love to see Iowa State and Drake play in the second round. But Iowa State, Creighton, and then we're wondering if you think Nebraska is going to get their first ever NCAA tournament victory. So could you tell us how far you have Iowa State, Creighton, and if you have Nebraska winning a game?
I do do, by the way, have Drake winning that first round game and playing Iowa State.
There we go.
Round.
There we go.
So I do have that. That's another 10 over 7 upset that I picked. I think I had Iowa State losing in the either the Sweet 16 or Elite 8. I can't remember off the top of my head.
Mm-hmm.
I have Creighton losing in the Sweet 16. But to me, that point, that game, that potential game against Tennessee, presuming it happens, to me, that's sort of like the focal point for me in the Sweet 16, because I believe that the winner of that game is the best challenger to Connecticut for the national championship. Whoever gets out of that game is the best qualified team to beat UConn. There are very few teams, I think, that cover most of the prerequisites for a national champion. UConn covers them all easily. Tennessee is really close. Creighton is really close. Creighton probably not quite as talented as you'd want in order to win it all. Purdue also fits the description of not being quite as talented as you'd usually want to win it all. But those teams, I think, that whoever comes out of that Midwest, and so I look at Creighton and Tennessee out of that Sweet 16 game, but Purdue would fit that description as well. So whoever comes out of that Midwest game is the team I think is best situated to deal with UConn.
And who did you have winning Nebraska, Texas A&M?
Yeah, I have Texas A&M winning. I think it's a very close game, obviously, as reflected by the seeds. But Texas A&M, the guards are very, very good. And we'll see whether or not one of the things that's interesting about Nebraska, as I was, this really dawned on me. I covered them all year for the Big Ten Network. We had them on our air a lot while Rachel Davis and John Beilein and I were doing Big Ten basketball and beyond and that sort of thing. And I noticed this more in person, that when Fred Hoiberg subs, they are a completely different team. They put this guy in, now they're this. They put that guy in, now they're that. And it's really hard to deal with. But sometimes they have a little bit of trouble sustaining it to the end. And I'm not sure they always can grasp onto, okay, we are so many different teams. Which is the best team to close this game? So if it's close, then I think Texas A&M has an edge just in terms of knowing how to win that end game. But Texas A&M is so inconsistent. They belong actually in the West region. They would be a better fit in the 8-9 game in the West region, because I mean I think they had 6 quad one wins and then like 7 losses against teams that weren't in the field. I mean that's how erratic they were, and so certainly they could come out and play one of those other games today and put Nebraska in a great spot.
Great stuff, Mike. Thank you so much for the time. We appreciate it. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, guys. Enjoy the tournament.
We will. That's Mike DeCourcy helping you fill out your bracket from the Sporting News. Back after this on WHB.